Our next speaker. I'm sorry, but we have to stay on a schedule of some form or we'll never have lunch. I'm motivated by that. I don't know. So, thank you all. Our next speaker has written extensively on this topic, and we're very fortunate that he was part of the advisory committee and was a key member in identifying some of the speakers and the format today. So we appreciate his help. Dr. Chris Wildman from Cornell University and Rockwell Foundation Research Unit of Cornell. Is that of Cornell?
Denmark.
I did not know that, so thank you.
Yeah. So thanks for the introduction, Wendy. I feel like every time I'm giving a talk, I am like the person who separates everyone from lunch. which would be bad if I were long-winded, but since I like giving like 6-minute presentations, it ends up working pretty well together. I've been told that I cannot present for only 6 minutes today. So today I want to try to do a couple things aside from not humiliate myself publicly. No, you can come this way. So first I want to present sort of a very basic figure of different types of criminal justice contact. I then want to talk a little bit about where most research is in this area. I then want to talk a little bit about disparities, but in maybe a slightly non-standard sort of way. And then I want to talk a bit about mechanisms, not a tremendous amount here, because I think, as Mike alluded to, it's a bit muddy because of the measures that we currently have. And then I definitely want to not take up too much time. So Mike, I think, did a really, really great job of focusing on the incarceration component of things. But I guess one of the things that I wanted to talk about a little bit and that I think fits really well was sort of the charge of this group is to talk more broadly about criminal justice contact. And Mike did such a good job of covering everything that this would be the only way that I would still have something left to say. So this is, I'm glad I spent time making this figure. So theoretically, we start with crime, right? Although I think, Jody, your point was really well taken earlier that, you know, we make these assumptions about folks' levels of criminality that may or may not actually be tied to their criminal justice contact. And I do think that's an important thing for us to think about. Folks then theoretically end up having some form of contact with the police, or they don't, and then they sort of drop out of our criminal justice contact model. This is super insanely simplified, and I'm sure I messed up like 19 steps, by the way. So I'm just going to say that directly, but I think it'll help orient things. Folks can then end up getting arrested or not getting arrested, charged or not charged. And then if they are charged, they can end up getting bail or not getting bail. So this ends up being sort of the first time that we see jail incarceration, although I'm not really talking about it until the end of the figure. You then have folks get convicted or not get convicted. And then if they are convicted, there could be sort of a host of other of sanctions as a result of getting convicted. And then if they experience prison incarceration, eventually, if they do get released, they could end up either on parole or they can end up unsupervised. Now, I know that there are things that I've probably missed or dramatically simplified in this criminal justice contact figure, but I do think it's important for us to think about the fact that it's not just variations within incarceration that are important for us to think about when we think about differences. There are also all these variations across different levels of criminal justice contact. The other thing that this figure makes me think about a bit is, you know, Dan, I appreciated your comment about sort of what's the comparison group, like how are we sort of teasing out causality here. And I guess one of the things that I think we'll have to decide as a group, and maybe we can get close to reaching a consensus by the end of the day tomorrow, but so there's a causal way to think about all this stuff, right? And I think most of the more social science-y folks in this room are going to err in terms of thinking about the causal kind of framework, like what's the unique effect of prison incarceration relative to jail incarceration or something. But I guess one of the things that for me is really exciting about having OMH at the table and thinking more within this public health perspective is we can think about designing a series of questions or suggesting a series of questions where we're thinking about criminal justice contact not as a causal factor, but as a risk factor in the public health sort of sense. And there, we're not trying to tease out causal effects, but we're saying, if we know that somebody's been arrested, how does that help us think about their risk of having a bunch of other sorts of negative health outcomes, mental health outcomes, these sorts of things? And so I do think as we're going through these questions, and as we're going through the next couple days, it is important to think about, because, you know, Mike suggested these sort of longitudinal studies, and I think, you know, although I agree with Dan in a bunch of ways, I think those are a good way to move forward in terms of thinking about causality. But if we're thinking about sort of risk factors and sort of markers for poor health or poor health outcomes, it might be that plopping a couple questions onto NHANES is actually a lot better for helping our understanding of the connections between criminal justice contact and health. So that's a bit of an aside, but I'm like covering a bunch of different things, so I feel like I can have random asides sometimes. By the way, the bad thing about being on the committee and giving a presentation is you can't complain about the assignment you get for your presentation, so I feel like I like indirectly did this to myself, although there was like a 10-minute stretch where I lost cell service during one of the calls. So I feel like this is probably when this happened. So the next thing I'm going to do is talk a little bit about sort of where most research is. And I'm just going to do this in sort of broad strokes. I think Mike, again, did a really, really nice job of highlighting this. But I want to sort of try to do it again. The other thing is, here and throughout, I really want to try to focus exclusively on health, right? So I don't want to get into sort of the broader labor market outcomes or these other sorts of things. I really want to try to focus on health. I think some of the other presentations, Chris and John and Holly, maybe yours will focus on sort of broader effects, but here I'm just trying to focus on what we know on health. And so I want to start with adults. And I guess the impression I have, and maybe this is wrong, but the impression I have is we have a bunch of information on the health of folks who have been in these different levels of criminal justice contact. So we know, you know, about the mortality of prison inmates, right? So Evelyn's done a bunch of work on that. We have a limited amount of information on sort of the physical and mental health of jail inmates, a lot of which comes from Rikers. We know a tiny little bit about probation, although it really just is a handful. So Emily and Anne, you're on that paper, right, Anne? We didn't drag you onto that paper. We tried. Anne's trying to ignore me. So we have a paper where we look at mortality of probationers in the U.S., basically. And then we have a little bit of information on folks who are on parole and who are unsupervised. Dave Rosen's done a bunch of good work, on that. And then we know a little bit about these sort of earlier stages of contact. But in terms of thinking about the connections between criminal justice contact and health, there's this whole sort of big middle piece where we really don't know a lot. Now, I guess in my opinion at least, the thing that's really nice about the literature on sort of the immediate connections between criminal justice and health for adults is that we actually have specificity when it comes to institution type. And I think when we think about sort of the broader spillover effects of incarceration on families and especially on kids, not only do we lose, I think, a lot of information on sort of police contact and on probation, but these things all become super mushy. And we basically ignored this whole side of things for the last 30 years in the sort of sociological literature. I mean, one of the things that Rob and John have talked about a bit is that this has kind of gotten ignored. Now, one of the things that's really tricky in terms of where existing researches and fragile families and the Project on Human Development in Chicago neighborhoods are sort of two of the data sets that folks use a lot, although John and Holly, I assume, will talk about at Health, which folks use a lot as well. One of the things that's really tricky here is you have these very sort of generic kind of incarceration questions where you don't know if it's prison or jail, you don't know if they've been convicted, you don't know much about crime type, You don't know much about if they've been in prison, whether they're on parole or whether they're unsupervised. We have, so Kristen Turney and Youngmin Yi and I have a paper where we do try to tease out sort of the facility type kind of information from fragile families, but we have so few reports that we think are reliable on facility type that it ends up sort of going awry. So I think the key sort of things I want you to take away from this in terms of where existing research is that there's a big hole in the middle, both for sort of immediate connections between criminal justice contact and health, and that for effects on kids and other family members who are in the household, there's a lot less specificity in terms of those connections than you might have otherwise. The next thing that I've been charged with talking about a bit is about disparities. And so we all have a sense, right, for how criminal justice contact is concentrated. So I'm not going to spend a whole bunch of time on that. But I do want to talk a bit about how the nature of the questions that we ask about criminal justice contact can actually influence the relative size of the disparities. And here I'm thinking most about racial disparities because that's where most of my work is. But these disparities aren't constant, right? And so you can think about both disparities in rates, and you can also think about disparities in rates by crime type, and you can also think about disparities in transition probabilities. And again, you can think about those by crime type. So disparities in rates would be disparities in the incarceration rate, for instance, or the imprisonment rate. But if we're talking about disparities in transition probabilities, we could talk about disparities from sort of having a drug arrest to having a drug conviction, right? And so there are actually very different ways to think through disparities. And so when we think about this, I mean, one of the things that I think we should think about a bit is whether we're more interested in sort of rates or transition probabilities. And if we're just interested in rates, like if we're just interested in sort of the imprisonment rate, then we don't actually have to think about a bunch of these earlier stages of criminal justice contact. But if we're also interested in transition probabilities and disparities at a bunch of different stages in criminal justice processing, then we do need to think about this. I think this isn't something that I see folks talk about that much in the literature on criminal justice and health, but it does strike me that when we're having a conversation about what sorts of measures we might ideally want to come up with, that it ends up being a really important thing to think about, because we could actually potentially have enough measures where we could pick up on a bunch of different stages. Now, the other thing that I think is worth thinking about a little bit here, and again, there's not a tremendous amount of work on this, but is thinking about whether we want sort of total measures or whether we want measures by crime type or by conviction type. And I think one of the things that's important to think about with this is by conviction type actually probably gives us a much better sense of racial disparities than just this total sort of measure. And although, you know, racial disparities are consistent, they do jump around quite a bit across sort of the criminal justice system. And so I think just like thinking through whether having a question on something like crime type or conviction type would be a possibility. So if you think about this for drugs, right, just thinking about sort of how the disparities jump around. So for drugs, once you hit sort of each different stage, the transition probabilities could really jump around, right? And the racial disparities of the transition probabilities could really jump around. And I think when we're designing questions, this ends up being pretty important. But if we think about it for something like homicide, you know, contingent upon charge, the racial disparities in the transition probabilities actually end up being pretty low once you hit that stage. So the actual total racial disparities end up being pretty similar. I guess the reason that I wanted to talk about that a little bit is just because depending on the types of crimes that we're interested in, we may or may not need to have a whole bunch of different gauges of criminal or of sort of criminal justice contact. And so again, I think it's just important to, I'm trying to basically just hopelessly complicate what Mike said. Okay, so let's talk a tiny little bit about mechanisms. So I think there are sort of three things to think about with mechanisms. And I actually think that this is where it gets really tricky, which again, I think Mike alluded to. So first, there are differences across levels of criminal justice contact in terms of how the mechanisms could work, right? So the mechanisms driving the relationship between arrest and health could be very different from the mechanisms driving the relationship between imprisonment and health. And so those are mechanisms that we have to think about. But then there are also differences within a level of criminal justice contact, right? So John talked a little bit about solitary confinement. You could think about different security levels, different distances from family. Like there are a whole bunch of ways that you could think about that. The other thing that folks talk about a lot in the policing literature is that differences in the character of contact with police can end up having these very different effects, right? And so we can think about those sort of those are sort of two things to think about. The other thing, and I think this is something that's really, really important and something that, you know, Amanda alluded to in her really nice 2012 demography paper, and that you see folks sort of talk through at different times in the literature, but the mechanisms through which incarceration could affect someone or criminal justice contact could affect someone's own health versus these sort of broader spillover effects could actually be quite different, right? So somebody getting, I guess sort of the example I always think about is like somebody getting stopped by the cops and hassled and like patted down on their way to work and being late to work as a result and feeling really angry about that could have these really important kind of psychological effects on them. But that same encounter, they might be able to totally keep their kids removed from, right? So it doesn't affect the way they parent. It doesn't affect their sort of employment status, like all these other sorts of things. And so I think there is this sort of drift in the literature where we think about criminal justice contact having these kind of universal effects on individuals and families, but I think the mechanisms actually end up differing quite a bit. Now, the thing that ends up being really tricky with that is that for most of the family effects kind of literature, we have these really sort of mushy criminal justice contact measures, and so it's hard to tease that out directly. But as we're thinking about sort of questions that we might want to work through, I think it's an important thing to think about. So, and again, I think you could sort of go through and think through things in a bunch of different ways. One of the things that ends up being tricky in terms of the mechanisms, so you asked a question about residual variance, mm-hmm. right? So one of the things that's super tricky, and it relates to Dan's question about causality, is so basically every study we have where we seriously try to tease out mechanisms through which criminal justice contact affects any outcome, at best we explain about 40% of the association, and more often we're explaining about 25 to 40% of the association. So there are a couple things that could be going on with this, and I do think this is why I want to kind of hone in on this across different stages of criminal justice contact a bit. So the first thing is that 60% of it's not causal, right? So Dan, coming back to your sort of thing, like it could well be that there's sort of some unobserved selection process that we're not fully measuring, and so there is actually, you know, the association between criminal justice and health outcomes is about half as strong as we think it is. But the other possibility is that we just have really, really crummy sort of measures of mechanisms. And so as we're thinking through the criminal justice questions that we might want to have on a big health survey, it's maybe worth really honing in on which surveys already have pre-existing questions about the mechanisms through which we think criminal justice contact could affect health, so that those two things can sort of dovetail a bit more. Okay, so I should be done, but I lied, which means my presentation is not going to be quite as short as it would have been. I appreciate, too, that Mike lied a little bit with his, since he also gave us some suggestions on where to go. I mostly just think, like, the earlier we can get the conversation going about the specific things that we'd like to measure, the better. And so I just want to talk a bit about if we had maybe 5 questions, right, which I think is totally not how many questions we would get on a big health survey, right? Like, we get, like, 1/8 of a question. 2. So 2 I think we can still work with. But so if we had maybe 5, I mean, I think I totally want to look at Emily Wang's. Yep, that's exactly the expression I expected to get. Thank you, Emily. So I think it would be really interesting to think about having some sort of self-reported criminal activity kind of measure, and we could call these health behaviors. I'm continuing to get the unhappy expression from Emily, which is good. But I do think thinking about these sort of background behaviors or characteristics end up being really important, I think, for keeping scholars of the criminal justice system who are more kind of purist criminologists at the table. I mean, there are folks who are more crimmy than I am here, and so they can tell me that I'm totally wrong about that. It'd be great to have a question on whether somebody's ever been arrested. And I think one of the things that's nice about having a question on ever arrested is that you immediately get into this sort of risk factors kind of perspective at a very, very, very low level of criminal justice contact. It also means that you can potentially kick a bunch of folks into a skip pattern right away. So if you're trying to maximize sort of the amount of money that you have remaining for other questions, you could do that. Obvious, like, ever incarcerated sort of question, and then crime incarcerated for. It'll be interesting. Amanda, maybe you'll talk about this a bit tomorrow, but in Fragile Families, they try to get a sense for what crime folks were incarcerated for, and the information is, like, dodgy, I think, is the word that I would say in something that was recorded. I'll use a different word over drinks later. I do think it would be really interesting because of this transition probabilities sort of thing to have information on specific crime types. And then I think it would be interesting to have something about sort of the type of facility somebody was incarcerated in. Again, we're not going to get all of these, but just trying to sort of throw those things out. And I guess I do wonder a little bit, and maybe tomorrow when we have folks who are running big surveys talk about these things a little bit more, it would be interesting just to sort of hear about how much these skip patterns could potentially help with things. So I realize we probably don't have that many questions. It would be interesting, sort of, this came up in the previous session, but thinking about sort of the character of criminal justice contact, something like solitary, or thinking about sort of duration and frequency would also be great. I mean, I guess my naive impression, and I mean, maybe folks will disagree with me vehemently about this, but I mean, I actually think sort of DOC data is much better suited for getting that information out. Although, at the same time, like Holly and John, you've had good success, I think, getting at some of those things in the ad health data. So maybe you'll have different opinions. So that's all I wanted to do. I realize that it's kind of all over the place, but hopefully it gives us some more stuff to think about.
Thank you.
Okay, you can hear me. Good. And then, oh, I'm bad at this stuff. Oh, good. Somebody else is doing it. From the beginning. Okay, I did not pay Chris to end on that note, but it's actually worked out really perfectly, and I was afraid we were, I was going to be way off kilter here. As I said, I'm the co-director of the National Center for Family and Marriage Research, and why that's important is that this center was formed. It was called the National Center for Marriage Research under President Bush, 2007, and I'm happy to see Jennifer Bruninski here and Linda Melgren, who are both key program officials that were associated and provided great guidance for the center. And we eventually changed the name when Obama became president to the National Center for Marriage and Family Research. So, but one of the key institutions that we thought was important at the time to study further was the incarceration experience. And it was an important context for understanding the health and well-being of children, youth, and families. And so this center received support from the Department of Health and Human Services for really trying to move forward some of our data infrastructure on these questions. And at the time the center was formed, and as everybody knows, I don't need to show this group this chart, just the increase in the population that was under some form of criminal justice supervision, whether it was incarceration or just general supervision, such as probation or parole. And of special interest, of course, is the disproportionate experience of minorities, specifically African Americans and economically disadvantaged, and what that meant in terms of long-reaching ramifications. And so what we did, this is from our webpage, this is going to be a major ad for our center, but there's a resources by topic, and if you clicked on that button, you could pick here incarceration. There's many other great topics, like gray divorce, which isn't relevant for today, but we'll just hit the incarceration button. And what we have here is we had a forum in 2012. So we supported the research of many people here in the room, as well as we provided some data resources. We did an original data collection. And what we notably did for today is in January, we had an invitational forum that was specifically focused on this exact topic we're discussing 4 years later. So I feel like a little bit like a Groundhog's Day for me, but and some of the same people were there. So, but we're all looked the same as we did 4 years ago or 5 years ago. So, but there's many resources here, and I encourage you to check them out. And the one that I want to start off with is this, and this isn't a very friendly format, but we tried to look at different surveys. Just, I'm a family demographer. I love to compare data across surveys. And we've talked about a few of these surveys today. And we were just looking at the incarceration by age 25 and across these different surveys. And you could see this is just any experience that was reported by respondents using the National Survey of Family Growth, the NLSY-97, and the Ed Health. And you can see that there's different levels. And this is men, sorry, not everybody. You can see there's very different levels depending on which survey you use. And as a demographer, this is quite troubling to me because we're trying to get accurate assessments of counts. And we're puzzled by this. We knew the profound potential implications of these experiences. And what we have on our page is we explain how in different data sets people ask these questions. And I think it's going to be relevant to today and tomorrow as we talk about this. And then when you're using, for example, the Ed Health, ever jailed is a simple one, and this is just what you get when you ask one item questions. And I just want to present that as a case for why we don't want to maybe ask 10 questions, but one item might not be sufficient. And this was just simply, have you ever spent time in jail, prison, juvenile detention center, or a correctional facility? NLSY, which is a survey that's asked via phone for the follow-up, and they're asked if you've been, if somebody has ever been jailed, if you'd ever been arrested and charged by the police since the date of the last interview. And then they were asked, were you sentenced to spend time in a corrections institution like a jail, prison, or youth institution, and goes on. So in the NSFG, they also have a question, in the last 12 months, have you ever spent any time in a jail, prison, or juvenile detention facility? Have you ever spent, and then just have you ever? So these are just some examples of variation across surveys. We could do this across many other surveys, but I just wanted to introduce that
as a real issue, and the implications are we get wide variation in the measurement, and this is important when we're trying to understand the implications of these experiences. So in January, we had this invitational forum, and it was really to discuss the importance of including these experiences in a population-based survey. And we featured many folks who are here today and some others who are not, but you can look at the agenda if you're at all interested. What we did at the end of this was we decided to pursue a pilot data collection. So everybody in the room said, yes, we need to try to come up with new ways of measuring this, some of the same conclusions that we're using as a starting point today. And we need to really improve our national data infrastructure to try to understand this experience that has such important implications for children and families. And so then we were charged with doing this actual data collection, which was a little challenging. And with Susan Brown at Bowling Green, we came up with an online panel. We relied on online panel data from Knowledge Networks. We recognized this was just a pilot data. It wasn't meant to be the final word on this topic by any means. We drew on the experts who were in the room and asked them, if you could just ask a few questions, what would you ask? Everybody had different answers. You saw Chris's perspective just now. There were people wanted to have multiple indicators. They thought it was important to capture timing of experience and also the conditions of confinement. And so we tried to keep that in mind in generating this pilot data. It was we focused on adults who were 18 to 64. It was conducted in May of 2013, and we had 3,200 respondents. We had about a 62% completion rate, which is very good for an online panel survey. And others can speak about this issue in terms of trying to capture criminal justice experience in terms of response rates maybe tomorrow. We divided our work into two categories. We had experience and supervision. So a lot of terms are being used today and tomorrow, I'm sure. I'm not a criminologist. Most of what I've learned about this are from reading the work of people who are here here today. But in terms of experience, we decided to focus on arrest, conviction, probation, jail, and prison. And so those were, if you had experienced any of those things, you had some sort of criminal justice experience. In terms of supervision, if you had been, if you're under probation, served time in jail or prison, then you had some supervision experience. Now, there's probably a lot of debate whether this is comprehensive or too broad, but this is what we used and might be a good starting point for thinking about some next steps. This is a chart, so I guess, Chris, you had a complicated chart, and I have one too, which is showing you some of our skip patterns. And we started by just asking if they had ever been stopped by the police, if they had been arrested, booked, or charged, whether they convicted or pled guilty to a charge, whether they had served probation, jail, or prison time, and if they'd ever been in a juvenile detention, served time in a juvenile detention center. We avoided some of the skip patterns that have been introduced in other surveys, partly because maybe as an outsider, I used to think that the criminal justice was a neat funnel, and that's but it's not. And so that you can have these, I didn't know you could be jailed without having been really convicted of a crime, and that I've learned from my colleagues that many of the people who are currently in jails or have not been convicted of any crime yet. And so it's not a neat funnel. And so we need to keep in mind that when we're thinking about health surveys and people's experience and how a few days of not being convicted in a jail might have serious implications, more so than we might imagine. So we started with these sort of yes-no questions. We tried to establish if they happened since age 18 or not. We tried then to move on to types of charges. And then number of times, how long. So we try to capture all of these things, but the problem is you need large sample sizes to really get at a wide variety of experiences. And so it depends what kind of data you're starting with in order to capture, have enough variation in these experiences. And you'll see from my chart how that can fall apart pretty quickly. And so today I'm just going to focus on sort of the recent and ever experiences, but there we have a report which you're welcome to check out. The data are available from ICPSR for anybody to use, so we encourage you, if you're curious, to pursue that. So in terms of the timing of experience, since age 18, have you ever been stopped by the police? We sort of had one category, arrested, booked, and charged, and another, convicted or pled guilty, and another, in probation, jail, and prison. And then and I know that sometimes in some states it's not age 18, it's age 16, but this is also a complication that states have such different rules about the criminal justice experience, that is also something that's not well captured and something that we often ignore. But this is just what we did for pilot data, and then we try to get try to separate out the juvenile experience from the adult experience through prior to age 18, and then asking specifically about juvenile detention. And then what was more complicated, so we said, well, ever experiencing it, but don't we want to know more about, have you recently experienced this in the last 12 months? Which was a little strange when I thought about it in hindsight, because if you had to have been someone who was released relatively recently, and so the levels are going to be pretty low. But we, again, tried to capture whether these things had happened in the last 12 months, either by asking specifically that or asking a specific date. Sometimes if you ask the last year, you're going to get a really broad answer. And if that is important to you to get the recent experience, that we were focusing on the theme of using an actual date and not actually just saying in the last year or the last 4 weeks or something like that. In terms of supervision, again, we had the any and the recent experience. So it was any adult experience, just sort of a yes, no, and then dividing also again into the recent. And if somebody was currently on probation, we were asking about when does it end, and or if it had been over, when did it end. Here's just some quick graphs. The dark blue lines are about experience. The brown line is about supervision. I'll show you a series of different graphs. This is just based on our survey respondents. About 21% said they had some criminal justice experience. So it was about 1 in 5 had. Of course, most of that experience is being having an arrest. Many of those don't end up in any conviction, but we had about 10% pled guilty or were convicted. So out of a household sample of about 3,000 folks, these were the levels we were getting. And we asked about any criminal supervision, then we got to a lower level, which was about 10%, about 1 in 10 of the sample. Of course, these things vary a lot by age, gender, relationship status, whether or not you have children. Today, I'll just show you some results for women and men. And as you would expect, we saw much lower levels, about half the levels among in any criminal justice experience among women than men. And then in the actual supervision, it was 3 times lower for women than for men. When we look at race, ethnicity, again, you see the expected differentials. With the any criminal justice experience, we have much higher levels among African Americans, but still pretty high levels among whites and Hispanics. And then we see a greater divide occur when we actually look at who's been experienced criminal justice supervision. So the survey was, in fact, capturing the known differentials that you would observe in other data. And then when we tried to get at recent experiences, we felt our data were getting a little thin. But when we looked at recent criminal justice experience, about 3% of the sample reported that, and only 1.6% under some recent supervision. When we looked at men under age 30, those are, of course, the subgroup that has the highest levels, we see about 6% had some experience and about 3% had some form of supervision. We tried to compare these results to the National Survey of Family Growth. That was a data set that had recently been collected at the time we completed this. It was a cross-sectional survey, so it had some of the same features as the online panel in that it was just a cross-sectional data set, not a longitudinal data collection like the Ad Health or the NLSY data. We limited our analysis to just men who are ages 18 to 44. And using the NSFG, we had much higher levels who had some residential criminal supervision than we did in our pilot data. And one reason we think that probably occurred is that maybe the NSFG respondents were really capturing any criminal justice experience, which we, when we computed that, it was about 26%. And that maybe this question is really tapping into any criminal justice experience and not really just supervision. And we're not, and we would advocate that if you were to pursue this, to really do some careful cognitive interviews and make sure that people are actually answering the questions you think they're answering, and to encourage folks to do this comparative work across surveys so that they can really see how who they're capturing in their responses. If you want to compare how these questions are asked across a lot of different data sets, we have that set up on our webpage. We give you the question wording, the respondents, the variable name, where it is in the code book. For example, we have the fragile families here, and it's all organized. So it's pretty easy if you want to see how different data sets are actually collecting some of this information, which might be a good resource when we think about some next steps or try to coordinate across across surveys. So just to sum up and give time for discussion, I'm really excited about this opportunity to reignite this discussion about best practices. We want to acknowledge wide variation across states and that there's just this complex system of federal and state experiences that are sometimes not well captured in our relatively simplistic questions. I've been really struck by the majority of individuals in jail are not yet convicted, but yet may still suffer a significant negative or trajectory of disadvantage based on that experience. And then also just to, as Chris mentioned, to think about the measurement that's most appropriate for health outcomes. So there's a lot of measures we could consider if we really wanted to understand criminal justice experience of Americans, but really what is it that's gonna be most useful for understanding and trying to resolve some of the disparities we're observing in health outcomes. Thank you. So we're open for questions or comments by the group.
Chris, two things, I think. One, you put a lot of emphasis in your five questions on crime type, and particularly you said conviction type. And I worry about that for two reasons. One is 90% of the cases are plea bargained. So in fact, my robbery may be a different crime type conviction. And secondly, in terms of thinking about some of the mechanisms that Mike talked about, I'm trying to think about why would crime type matter in terms of the mechanisms?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I mean, happily, we'd have to cut a few regardless, so maybe those are just the first ones to cut. I mean, I guess part of why I thought putting the emphasis on that was just because it seemed like a nice way to tap into the disparities piece a little bit more. But, I mean, I'm totally open to it maybe not being the best way to do that. And, I mean, I think, and again, Amanda, maybe you could...
It's Amanda Geller.
Yeah, sorry, Amanda Geller. I mean, Amanda, maybe you can speak to this, but I wonder, I mean, one of the things that I guess I hadn't fully thought through beforehand, but just like thinking out loud now does make a little bit more sense. Like, if folks are pleading down, that might explain why people are so bad at reporting what they were actually convicted of. And so maybe you're just going to get a super, super noisy measure regardless. But yeah, no, it's a good... So those two are done.
It's also the police are kind of... They're pleading. They oh, well, okay. You know, they just add to the laundry list. And so there may or may not be some relation to what actually happened, to what gets in. And then, as you point out, the final result is different.
This gets into the ambiguity. I mean, Dave Kirk's work in Chicago, when he was asking kids, were you arrested... what's an arrest? I mean, I grew up in Chicago and there's stopped, questioned. There's stopped, questioned, put in the police car, driven around, let go, stopped, questioned, put in the police car and brought to the police station where your parents were called. Was I arrested three times or once? I don't know.
Okay, I think David had a question.
Well, just to go
I mean, maybe it's not the 32 classification crime type, but it seems to me you need to know something about distinguishing between, you know, you're having a fight with your ex-wife and you're under some sort of order and maybe you got convicted of something, to distinguish between the really serious stuff and the stuff that many people will say yes to on a survey. You know, have you been convicted of something? Yeah, well, I've been convicted of, I mean, some of these questions exclude traffic violations, but, you know, you can certainly see that a lot of people will say something that you're really not going to be very concerned about. So at that level, I think crime type would be important.
I think Daniel and then Amanda.
Just to elaborate on that is the point that was just made. The reason it seems to me that crime type or some indication of the nature of the legal infraction whether is important is because I think it's very important for policy, from a policy perspective. That is, I mean, distinguishing between people who have committed some kind of legal infraction, setting aside all of, you know, Jody's concerns, where you scratch your head and say, why is this person even, you know, in the system, given the nature of the infraction, versus somebody who has committed a very serious crime, like setting your neighbor on fire, and that those kinds of people. Types of people may need mental, you know, health treatment, but it's going to be inside a correction facility. And so understanding the nature of the offense seems to me to be quite important to understanding and thinking about what the appropriate policy response is.
So two things. So two things. One, building on what Dan was just saying. So building on what Dan was saying in terms of the importance of having some note of what the person was arrested, convicted, incarcerated for, I think it's also relevant because when we are interested in distinguishing the effects of criminal justice involvement from the effects of criminal activity involvement, being able to disentangle some of those kind of distinct behavioral versus externally imposed risk factors is important. But another thing I wanted to say gets back to the question of plea bargaining and charging decisions. Given how many arrests and how many convictions are the results of plea bargaining, and I think I might be jumping ahead to questions we might want to ask, I think considering plea bargaining almost completely separately from externally imposed conviction types might be important, because once we're into plea bargaining and the charging decision that might be determined based on the likelihood of a plea, we are into so much endogeneity in terms of what these treatments are that we may not be able to distinguish causality. We may not care about causality depending on the question we're asking, but we need to at least recognize that this is, you know, two people that are convicted of the same charge didn't necessarily follow the same treatment.
Rashida, if you have a comment you want to make, just put up your name tag. Yep. Thank you. So, Wendy, I actually had a question for you. For the survey of criminal justice experience, for the questions that you used, did you do any cognitive testing, or what criteria did you use in order to select the measures that were ultimately included?
So we drew on what had been used in the field. So we had collected all what national surveys had used to collect this experience. And then we came up with a sort of short list based on what happened at the forum. And we emailed everybody who was there and said, what do you think about these? And we got feedback from the research community. We did not do cognitive testing, and that's why I'm sort of encouraging for round two that might occur. And based on some of our analysis, I think that would be important.
And just one follow-up question. So for the questions that you pulled from existing sources, did you also look to see if they had been cognitively tested or the quality of those measures? Or was...
We dug back as far as we can. Okay. What we found with a lot of the surveys, people were just saying, well, we put the question in. We don't have an expert on this anymore. That person's not here. So it was sort of difficult to track. I found it surprisingly difficult to track back to why those questions existed or didn't exist on a survey. But we can. But I think that those are good questions. Candace?
Yeah, I was just going to say... For a lot of the reasons John mentioned, what they were arrested for, I think it's really bad. But I also think that focusing on length of incarceration, which is highly correlated with some offense categories. Now, it could be confounded with the number of priors you have, right? If you're in for your third drug, your length of your sentence is going to go up. But I think length of incarceration would be much, much more relevant.
I mean... Do I get to respond? Yes. So I guess
give me your time's up.
I always think length of incarceration would be interesting too, but I mean, I guess my read of that literature, and Mike, you can totally correct me if I'm wrong, but I mean, my impression is that contingent upon experiencing prison incarceration, duration doesn't seem to have a ton of action in terms of health outcomes. It's a very, very small literature that measures that stuff well, but at this point it doesn't look like it.
It's really hard to believe. It's a small literature. I mean, that's exactly our point. My point. So just to back up Candace, I mean, I think, and I kind of second John's point, which is, and I want to kind of clarify, it's not that I'm at all opposed to measuring criminal activity. I want to, you know, acknowledge the robust literature that is out there and kind of criminologists at hand really teasing out issues of endogeneity. But I do want to say is that we have a limited kind of, real estate on these health surveys, and to acknowledge that I'd love 5, but if we could get 2, that wouldn't be first, second, third, it wouldn't be up there. So, to me, I would suspect kind of hypothesis generation, thinking about kind of exposure to incarceration, that length of incarceration, as well as the dose, the frequency you move in and out, might be the key kind of questions to add. And so those kind of, I think, are really important. And then my fifth would be, and I have my 5 too, would be asking a question about whether or not someone in the household has been incarcerated, to get at issues broader beyond the individual experience and moving us to families. And so to me, that's much of kind of where we build kind of public discourse and interest in issues of incarceration, moving towards the instead of them issue, but we.
Holly had a
This is just further to Chris's presentation. Just thinking about some of the ways to measure confinement and involvement, wondering if we should be thinking about a question about being retained in an immigration detention center. And we don't seem to be asking about that.
Yeah. That'd be great.
So... I think that discussion about what category people would be classified in made me kind of think about the sort of national discourse of violent versus nonviolent criminal. There seems to be a line there, and we're Homo sapiens. We all have the potential to be violent and in the right circumstances, and it's somewhat. I guess my remarks are perhaps colored by spending half a day a week for the last 22 years with people who are incarcerated, many of with violent, many nonviolent, and that's a fairly arbitrary distinction in many cases. I'm thinking about Glenn's, having someone put a gun to his belly and take his ring, or the other traumatic experience he described. I think it's, but we should think about our, in a sense, our audience, because we want to be very careful about the sort of spin we put on this. And I think if we if we come out of this, say, oh, well, we've tapped into all these national studies, and we find out that, you know, the so-called violent offenders, and offenders in quotes, are the ones that are real problems, and those we should just, you know, throw away lock up and throw away the key. We might not be helping the problem. So I think we just need to be mindful of the. I think we should look. I think to the extent that we can, we should try and tease out what these different categories are, but mindful of how we use that data in terms of spinning it to get our ultimate goal of reducing all this crazy incarceration.
Thank you. I think we have Chris and then David.
Yeah, it's a fascinating conversation, and I don't know how best to use the real estate. I've always been frustrated though in presenting information on punishment that people think I'm talking about crime. And, you know, in Minnesota, the arrest rate, particularly on disparities, the arrest rate is 227 per 1,000 per year for African Americans. So it's a huge number of people brought into the system, and largely for rather trivial things. So I thought about this. I know there wouldn't be room for any kind of self-report inventory probably, but gosh, it'd be nice to know if you've ever, you know, hurt somebody badly enough to send them to the hospital, or whether you yourself have been hurt badly enough to be sent to the hospital, or some simple indicator like that. It would help me in this sort of work that I do in trying to understand some of these enormous disparities.
Yeah, just switching the topic slightly, I think going to Wendy's comparison to the NSFG, I also wonder not just the questions, but the coverage. So, you know, the Knowledge Networks panel, you know, it's a 62% completion rate, but the actual response rate is probably well less than 10% once you account for all the recruitment that they do. So when comparing to the NSFG, which probably has like a 70 or 80% response rate, maybe not quite that high, but... It seems that even for high response rate surveys, when you're trying to look at something like incarceration and the serious effects of incarceration, the coverage for surveys isn't the best. So when
I agree with you, and I mean that it's a huge selection issue in terms of reporting on what people might be fearful of reporting on and might not care to report on in terms of social desirability. And certainly the advantage of a panel data set that this was meant to be pilot work and we are not trying to represent, but I was just demonstrating that even with this, whatever sample it is, we were getting the similar levels of disparity that you would observe in some other data sets. And so I guess it was just used really as a tool to try to think about what are some viable questions. And the advantage is really cost and timeliness. So in a, and it has its place, but it certainly cannot replace the major health surveys by any means.
Yeah. I was just commenting on the differences between the NSFG. I think that's another explanation.
Yes, possibly.
I want to elaborate on a point that Chris made and I made earlier, is that it's important to keep in mind that, you know, as Chris pointed out, that over 80% of the arrests in the United States are for misdemeanors or summary offenses. So they're not for serious crimes. And a backdrop for this entire discussion is a view that we have way too many people in jails and prisons, and there's a question of, well, and to what degree the size of these populations, can you put a dent in it, a meaningful dent in it, by diverting from prisons and jails people who are better off being treated from their mental illnesses? Having said that, if you commit a crime in which you seriously hurt somebody, I'm not going to enter into whether or not it's good or bad policy that you should wind up going to prison for that. But the reality is, in this country, if you do that, you are going to go to prison. And if you're suffering from a serious mental illness as well, then you should be treated for it. But it's going to have to happen in that context. And so that was why I said that it was important, to me at least, from a policy perspective, to understand why the person was, you know, in the criminal justice system, so as to distinguish, in a way, going back to Chris's point, between people, you know, well, I'm just repeating myself, to make that important distinction, because I think it's just a reality of the way the American criminal justice system works, for good or bad.
Okay, I think we're getting close. We have some good food for thought. I don't want to cut us short, but I also want to give us time to continue some of these conversations during lunch and after lunch. Agnes has some blue cards, so if you were going to go have lunch upstairs on
the
third floor, go to the end of the hall. There's some stairs you can walk up, or there's an elevator. Agnes will give you a card that's good for unlimited, whatever you want to get. Yeah, no cap, I guess.
Right, just make sure you sign the bottom. And then when you go to the register, just hand them your card.
And so I appreciate everybody's work this morning, and we'll reconvene back here at 1:30. And you can leave things here. So thank you. No,